Starting recording. Welcome, everybody. This is the Aries Working Group A call. It is April 8th, and we got Sven's here as our presenter. I forgot to record before we did introductions, but so we did introductions. Thank you, everybody. That was nice. As we normally do, please add yourself as an attendee. I forgot to put the link into the Zoom chat so it's easy for everybody to add themselves an attendee. It helps to know who is who's part of which conversations. Sometimes that's really useful coming back later. We always remind everybody about the Hyperledger Code of Conduct. We want to be nice to each other, and the antitrust policy, follow the law, that kind of thing. And we were talking about this COVID pandemic world we live in. So IW is still going to happen at the end of the month, but it will be an online unconference, and that's going to be interesting. We'll miss out on some social stuff. That's going to be sad probably, but it'll be fun to be able to do. I'm very interested to see how they're going to organize an online unconference. They've got a pretty good plan, a tool they're going to use for that, and that's going to be, it's going to be a great experience. So encourage everybody to plan around that. Any other announcements? Okay, other call conversation. We have the Aries Working Group B call that happens every week. This call is every other week because this is the time zone where it's complicated to have meetings. But they do have the B call scheduled for today. We're going to do discuss the out-of-band protocol and issuing credential version 2.0. So that should be interesting. The last B call, actually, those were the topics on the last B call. Sam, what's the plan for today?
Steven's in charge today.
Steven, what's the plan for today?
What's the plan for today? We've got issues. We've got a bunch of series of demos. We've got a mediator demo to be presented, and we've got some work on tracing that has been done. So for performance tracking, tracing of time spent in protocols, executing protocols. And after that, I've done some updates on the 2.0 issue credential RFC version 2.0, and we want to get that pushed out so we can start to work with a variety of verifiable credential models other as well as Indy.
Excellent. Thank you for that. And for people who can't attend, we do get the recording posted. Last week's recording is not posted, but it's usually posted. Did that recording get lost?
No, I'll do it.
Okay. So last week's recording will be posted, and expect to have this week's recording posted shortly after tomorrow or the next day. So you'll be able to catch up on those meetings. Anything else we want to say about related meetings?
Yes, Sam, can you send me whatever I need to know to be able to turn on recording for this afternoon?
Yes, I'll be there so I can do it. Okay. But it's more complicated than I'd like.
Okay.
You have to claim host. So you have to have the host code and then claim host.
Exactly. Yeah. I was saying what's the host code, but okay, good. Thank you. Sorry about that, Richard.
No, that's a good collaboration. As for work status updates, we went through a lot of this on the Indy call on Monday, so we don't necessarily need to go into – I apologize. I was supposed to update some of these with the results from the Indy call on Monday. But I know Andrew has made good progress on the Indy VDR. He's got a pull request that he's looking to get merged. Sergey said he would find time to review that this week. That's in progress. The Aries Credex, I know, has made a lot of progress there as well. So you can follow that progress in those repositories. We have not yet done an area shared utility because it's not really the highest priority. And the BC Gov team, I believe, Stephen, you said your next big project will be working on the Ares storage and the part that's not key management. Is that correct?
No. Storage generally.
So it will be storage including key management.
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent.
You can leave the name for now. It's very confusing the different names we have. So because KMS doesn't go far enough, but it is needed. It's a separate piece. Anyway, don't worry about it for now.
Sounds good. Any updates on? So I know we have the Akapai user group meeting.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to highlight in this call?
So two things. One, release 05 is now getting close. Revocation is largely there. We are working with both StreetCred and eStatus to get revocation working. We think that will enable use cases of, say, up to 50,000 or 100,000 credentials to be used in a revocation model. So that would be good. It still doesn't get us to what I'm now calling jurisdiction scope use cases where, you know, every citizen has a credential that can be revoked or something like that. It's not going to get us there, but it will get us, moderate size use cases. We're removing the deprecated issue credential, the version 01 protocols for issuing and presenting proofs. So those will be removed in the next release. They've been deprecated for probably 8 months, flagged as deprecated, and they're of course replaced with the 1.0 version of the exchange credential protocols.
Excellent. Great to see the work progressing there and real key features getting brought to the market. That's great.
And tracing.
Yes.
Talk about that this afternoon.
Yes. That's going to really help with performance evaluation. That's good.
Yeah.
Don't see any of the key stakeholders for the frameworks. I do know they've been continuing development. You can see a lot of that in Rocket Chat. Sam, anything you want to say about the toolbox?
No. There are a couple pending updates that are needed, and I'm hoping to get those in pretty quick. There's one small update for a dependency, and then there's some other small ones, but nothing yet.
AJ, anything you want to say about the JavaScript framework?
Yep, a very quick update that the contributors are meeting regularly, but we have very less contributions. The focus currently is not on really building the entire framework like .NET or Go, but to focus on only on the mediator part. Most of the work has been done, but few of the contributors are facing issues with the licensing with their existing customers. So there are some apprehensions, but yes, we'll have something resolved very soon and we'll have contributions in the repo.
Excellent. And at this point I haven't checked in a while. Has the repo been renamed to framework or is it still SDK?
It's been renamed to framework.
Okay. Excellent. Very good. I know that's one of the most widely requested frameworks, languages that people are building in. So anybody who's working on JavaScript, work with AJ. And I know they have a chat channel on Rocket Chat. Can
collaborate. What type of JavaScript is this? General? Is this Node? Is it React Native?
This is general JavaScript written in TypeScript, so, in fact.
Yeah. So like browser side?
No, it's a mediator agent.
So it'd be in Node?
Yep, running on Node.
Okay. Talk to me after, because I've written some stuff in JavaScript that wraps Rust, and it works really well. So.
Sure. Sure, Michael.
May I ask a question there? The Street Cred API, there's an API that's Node.js. What is the difference between the Street Cred Node.js framework or API and the Ares JavaScript framework?
Don't know. I don't represent Street Cred, so I have no idea.
Okay, I know they're doing. I had a meeting with Riley Hughes of Street Cred on Monday. And I've just started looking at it, and I know they've got an SDK that's written in JavaScript. So I wondered if there was some duplication. Not sure. I don't know either. So if you don't know, that's fine.
I'm wondering if this is just speculation, but I'm just wondering if theirs is an interface into their .NET framework versus a full framework on its own. In other words, it puts a layer, a wrapper around their framework so that you can use it with JavaScript. But
yes, it could be. This is a technology choice I've got to think about myself as to whether to go for the ACAPI Python or whether to use Street Cred's JavaScript myself. So I'll talk to Riley about this. Everybody knows Riley Hughes, and he'll answer this question. All right, thanks.
Yeah, the thing I'm working on is non-creds 2.0 stuff with wrapped so it works in Node.js, because a lot of people use it. So when I'm ready, I'll donate it to Ares. But I can issue credentials. I can create proofs with, you know, credentials 2.0 type stuff. So I'm working on the predicates now, but it doesn't use any FFI stuff, and it just goes straight from Node to Rust, which is really nice. So when I'm ready, I can demo it.
Cool. AJ, you came off mute. Did you have something to add?
I'm sorry, Richard?
You came off mute a second ago. I just want to make sure you had a chance to talk. So.
No, I'm good. Yeah, I'm done. Yeah.
Excellent. The other option, Mike, I don't know, Mike R, I should say. I don't know Street Cred's specific JavaScript, but it could be libindy provides a JavaScript wrapper, and it could be that they're supporting that. And the goal of the Ares framework JavaScript is to replace that libindy JavaScript wrapper with one that's more native. Instead of being a thin veneer on the Rust, it should take advantage of more JavaScript idiomatic abilities. So that's the difference between the Ares framework JavaScript and the indie JavaScript anyway. Any other questions, comments on that? Okay, the rich schema stuff has been going well. There's a proof of concept all the way through the stack at this point in various branches through the Indie VDR and Indie Node has all the support needed. But that work is largely being put on pause while we focus on some other projects. So don't expect a lot of short-term progress on that. We do intend to complete our effort on risk schemas, but we need to focus on another project for probably a month to 6 weeks. And then anybody have an update on Ozma?
There is no Ozma.
The new Ozma is not Ozma. It's called Ares Mobile Edge Xamarin. You've already got it in there. Followed the archive the old, have a merge commit on the new style to get that in there. And so that has been done. We need to make sure that we archive and transition the old repository, and I'm working on getting that done. So if you have previously worked against the Ozma repo, all the same code is there with just a couple of minor README updates, and you want to migrate your stuff there. I know it's a little bit painful to move from one repo to another repo, but that's the sanest way to get the DCO requirements satisfied with an older repo that doesn't have DCOs on the commits. So if you have worked with the Ozma repo, then you'll need to do a little bit of work to migrate over to the new one, but that's there.
Excellent. It's moved. much rejoicing. So I was going to complain that Ozma rolls off the tongue so nice. I was going to miss that name, but I just realized this is Ares Max. That's pretty good. That rolls off the tongue. I don't know why I decided that's a link. But yes.
That's awesome.
Okay, so it has its new name. Okay, so Ares Max. That's going to be nice. That rolls off. And Mike, anything on Ursa?
Yeah, I'm working on a bunch of stuff, doing some revocation things, just doing some minor tweaks here and there so that as I get ready to, I want to do a release or at least a push to Ares Credex so it can do all the stuff I was mentioning for Node, and anybody else who wants to wrap it can follow suit.
So that's the hash to curve, the improved hash to curve algorithm.
That's in there, as well as some other updates to, like the predicates.
And there was a conversation previously about having a replacement for AnOnCrypt OthCrypt sealed box for pack unpack. That's what my notes said, but I don't know what that means.
So does this relate to the new JWM stuff that we've been talking about over in the diff DidCom working group? We have some standards based versions of that don't require deviations from specs, or at least future specs, and so that's in a way, is that what you're asking about?
So it was on the in a previous conversation, Mike pointed out that Ursa has most of the functionality necessary to replace Libsodium so far.
Oh.
And Sergey said, it's actually missing the AnOnCrypt OthCrypt seal box for pack unpack, whatever that means.
Yeah, that'd be the only thing.
I just want to make sure you knew about it and if that was part of 040 or not.
No.
Okay.
Nope.
Excellent. Any other updates people want to give? Okay, one item of business before we so Sven's our main presenter. He'll take the second half of the call. One other item of business. I really like the way Sam did this in the last Ares B call. Was we need to adapt to a global pandemic and a global recession. We recognize the things we have personal responsibilities that complicate things. We need to stay healthy and take care of families that aren't in school or whatever. And so we recognize some things are going to take longer. I need to make sure this group is aware my role has changed at Evernym. I'm working more, instead of working directly on our contributions to Hyperledger, I'm responsible for more of our engineering practices across the organization and our product delivery. So I'm excited about that new role, but it is going to make it much more difficult for me to host this call. In addition, Evernym is a company. We got a really exciting opportunity to build out a COVID-19 identification system for a major healthcare provider. And so that is going to take all of our focus. It's this healthcare provider is in a rather stressed geography and is they're asking us to get this done. We're working. Anyway, it's taking all of our focus. Let me put it that way. So that's why we had to put rich schemas on hold and revocation, our work on revocation too. We don't intend to change long-term how we work with Hyperledger. We do want to keep contributing at a very high level, but for the next 4 weeks, don't be surprised if we're hard to get a hold of. So that leaves a question about this meeting. We do obviously have a presenter for today. Next meeting, we're going to talk about IoT best practices, and that's already set up, and I will be able to host that meeting. Starting in May, I won't be able to be a host. This meeting has been helpful for people that are in time zones where the afternoon meeting is inconvenient, but it's kind of a, but we do have the other meeting that will continue going. So the question is, do we want to keep a meeting in this time zone? Does somebody else wants to present Should we move to more asynchronous collaboration and watching the videos from the other meeting? Those are all options. We don't have to make a decision right now, but I need to make sure that this group's informed so that in the next meeting we can make a decision. Any thoughts on how we should proceed?
I think maybe we think about it and wait for a couple of weeks before we move. It's good to know that, and we'll think about it from there, I think is the best. Unless someone's going to jump up right now.
Unfortunately, Zoom lacks the ability to raise someone else's hand.
Exactly. It would get abused. So as I've watched my kids move to online meetings, I realize a lot of the tools we enjoy as professionals can be terribly abused by a bunch of kids doing remote learning. So, okay, well, that is that update. Any other business before we go to the presentation on formal verification? Okay, Sven, so I will stop sharing my screen. And you're on mute, Sven.
Yes, I just unmuted myself. Thanks. So, yeah, thanks for letting me present this. I will try to share my screen. Can you see a slide?
Yes, and this is great. I did a research project as an undergrad at school on formal verification and just thought, this is the future. We being able to prove correctness is so important for these underlying protocols. So I appreciate the work you've been doing on this, Ben.
Awesome, thank you. Okay, so this is about formal protocol verification. I will later give a bit more background on what that means and what it doesn't mean, just to be clear that it's about protocol verification. So first of all, why is this important? Why do we need this? And why is it also, I believe, important for this community in particular? So a bit of background, protocols are complex. The environment, the attacker, the network over which you run it is even more complex. And that means that even a small bug can undermine a protocol security, and we as human beings are quite bad at spotting these problems. And for that, I have an example, which is a classical example. It's called the Needham-Schröder Public Key Protocol, or NSPK for short. This is a three-line protocol that was believed to be secure for many years. So just three lines, and really three quite simple lines, where two people should agree that they're talking to each other. And despite being so apparently simple, it had a big problem that enabled a man in the middle attack. And that is why I'm going to tell you today why I think that we need these formal models and also like semi-automated tools such as model checkers or theorem provers in this space. And so before we can actually get any proofs or anything, before we can even start analyzing our protocol, we have the prerequisite is that we have precise definitions of both our protocols and our desired security properties. And I think this is a point that I want to make in itself, that having this is important and having this is valuable, even if you don't perform a full verification afterwards, just to talk about it. I have listened to many calls in this, both in ARIES working groups, both A and B calls, and also into the DITCOM working group calls. And I've noticed that in some of the discussions, I think the problem was that people are just not, it's just not clear what are the desired properties of some like DIT exchange protocol or similar. And since I mentioned DIT exchange, I've noticed some people talk about it in a way of, okay, we want this connection cannot be man in the middle. That clearly implies we want some sort of end-to-end security between two endpoints. But For example, what are these endpoints? Are there agents? Are there just DITs? Controller of DIT to controller of DIT? Are there people? And depending on what the answer is, changes a lot whether it's secure. And I'll get more details on this later.
Quick question? That's really cool what you're just saying there. It'd be really good to have ways that we can express that, or examples of ways that's expressed, so we know how to put that in there. That'd be really good.
Yes, I will see if I can contribute something. It's sometimes a bit difficult because sometimes I'm confused and what yep. like how the things you want map to what I know from the formal from the formal
exactly.
background.
Awesome. Good. Thank you.
So I'm not sure exactly how easy it will be to clarify that, but maybe I will go into a bit of the details of how these properties look. So first, let me maybe give a bit of a boundary. So what is, and so I will be talking about formal protocol verification, the symbolic model. And first, what is it about? It's about finding attacks that exploit flaws in the protocol logic, in the in the specification of messages and so on. So we don't only want to find the text, we also want to prove. So we want to prove that our protocol design provides desired security properties. But also, what is it not about? It's not about cryptography or cryptographic proofs. So how do we abstract this away? We work in the symbolic model, and in the symbolic model, we assume that cryptography kind of just works. So this is attacks on the underlying, on the used cryptography, on cryptographic functions, this is kind of out of scope of our analysis. And I'll come back to that later, explain a bit more details what I mean with cryptography just works. And also there's another kind of formal verification. It's formal program or code verification and proof that your code never gets deadlocked or even has some specific functional properties, is memory safe and so on. And that's just a separate concern. That's not my area of expertise. I think it's also probably a bit underused in industry and really making secure code, but it's just not something I have the expertise to talk about. Then, so let me talk a bit more about the symbolic attacker, a symbolic model, and what we call the Dolev-Yao attacker. So Dolev and Yao, there's two researchers that have this seminal paper about this. And so this is an attacker who controls the network. So we assume when we are communicating over insecure channels, and then we assume that the attacker can see, modify, block all messages. So we immediately see this model would not be useful, for example, to reason about availability, because the attacker could trivially do a denial of service attack. So this model is used to reason about security properties. And I'll talk about those later. But we abstract away the cryptography. We say that the attacker can derive terms, and we do this abstractly. So these terms, they're not bit strings. They're something more abstract. And I give one example here where we have symmetric encryption, and here from a key K and a plain text message MSG, one can construct these, also the attacker can construct encryption of message under key. And from the key and the ciphertext encryption message under key, one can, or the attacker can extract the message, but without knowing the key K, the attacker can neither obtain anything any useful information from the ciphertext, and also cannot construct encryptions under K. So this is implicitly modeling authenticated encryption, something like AES, GCM or similar. And that's just, again, it's even somehow more secure than any realistic encryption. But that's, again, because we're interested in flaws in the logic that we build on top of the encryption. And I think, especially maybe for this community, this can be useful, because from what I got, from some discussions and so on, it seems there is a lot of that there is cryptographic, there are cryptographers here, people with cryptographic background know their stuff. And so I think that that's maybe less the problem, the potential problem. And so let me, if we talk about security properties, so what we usually consider is our secrecy or agreement properties. So secrecy for a two-party protocol means when two honest parties, so there can always be parties that are somehow compromised under the control of this attacker, where the attacker knows, maybe knows their keys or something. But when two honest or non-compromised parties run a protocol to agree on a shared secret S, then the adversary should neither know or be able to learn S. And that's, for example, in session key negotiation. And it's easy to think, okay, that just means that some observer shouldn't be able to learn S when they observe that. But that's passive attacker. And we usually consider a potential active attacker who can also participate in the protocol, send messages, try to fool parties, modify messages, the parts that are somehow not integrity protected. Things like that. And by the way, feel free to interrupt me if you have questions now, but otherwise I would also have room for questions at the end, hopefully. There's for agreement, there's like the most common thing that we are interested in are called non-injective agreement or injective agreement. So first let's talk about non-injective agreement. Just means when two honest parties run a protocol, and this should somehow perform some authentication purpose, usually, that then they should agree that they are talking to each other. They agree on their roles, like who is the requester, who is the responder. Okay, I'm the requester, I'm talking to you, you are the responder. And they should also agree on certain data items. Something like, okay, we now agree on maybe just for example, maybe again in session key negotiation, maybe the attacker cannot learn the session key, but maybe somehow he can confuse the parties that they're somehow have different session keys now, and maybe that's not as bad of an attack, but it's still not what we want. And so these are some of the properties that we sometimes state the protocols should fulfill. And injective agreement additionally rules out replay attacks. I won't go into the formal details of how to define that. Parties, so two honest parties. I will just would like to point out what I mentioned before is who are the parties? Who are these endpoints talking to each other? That's an important part to make precise in the protocol. I just want to pause for a brief moment to see if there's questions up to here.
I got one. So this evaluation, I've realized, you know, we've got lots of protocols in Aries, but other than DID exchange, which is used to establish the channel, that's really what you're talking about in these. Or sorry, DID exchange. Because once you have the channel, it's considered secure between the two parties because everything going across it is encrypted and not visible. Would that be right?
This is a very, very good point. I would say in general, yes, this is really mostly about establishing secure channels. So if a protocol is not concerned with it's like some higher level protocol that performs some application functionality, it's not directly concerned with security, then it can somehow rely on the channel that was established by this original protocol, such as the exchange. Okay. But let's say that you perform some verifiable credential exchange of multiple parties, it could still be interesting to think about the properties that we want. For example, just like a proof. I mean, a lot of this, like some presentation proof, something like that. A lot of this is on the cryptographic level, but there could also, one would just have to like in a three-party protocol somehow, okay, the issuer is not involved anymore, but one could still think about how one would formalize these properties, whether there are, even if, let's say, just an example, another work I did is a formal analysis on and other people did as well. I wasn't the first to do that. It's a formal analysis of OpenID Connect. And OpenID Connect builds on TLS. So that means you could say, yeah, well, if TLS is secure, then and you use HTTPS everywhere where you exchange the messages, then obviously OpenID Connect is secure. But that's not obvious. There should still be logical flaws in the design of OpenID Connect. That means that there could still be attacks on OpenID Connect, even if every communication channel used is somehow secured with TLS. So yeah.
Got it. Cool.
So I got like a non-dev somehow sidestepping your question, but it depends. It's usual. Okay. So maybe I can move on. Yeah, I just want to briefly talk about tooling. And so my background is I'm a PhD student in the information security group at ETH Zurich, and we use, so it was original developed in this group, that's why we use it, and the tool Tamarin. There's the link there, insecure link too. So just a few remarks. So the underlying problem of protocol verification is undecidable. So you don't have termination guarantees, but there's good built-in heuristics, and it's possible to write like custom heuristics called oracles and Tamarin to like search. So it's just like a model checker. So it searches sort of like the state space of the protocol and different parallel sessions. And when it terminates, it either proves your security property, for unbounded number of sessions, no matter how many people talk at the same time using the protocol, the security property always holds. Or it provides a concrete counterexample. Concrete counterexample means an attack. And you can look at a graph, a graphical representation of the attack. So this can also be useful for attack finding, even if you're not that interested in a formal proof, you can find flaws. And other tools exist, and the closest to Tamarin is probably ProVerif. It uses a bit of different like mathematical formal theory behind it, but also works with like this unbounded number of sessions. There's other model checkers that have like bounded number of sessions, so they always somehow this becomes decidable. They always terminate after, but it may still be take a long time, but they always terminate. But then you know you have security if you have like at most 10 sessions or something like that. So there's different tools. Just Tamarin is the one I know. I thought about giving a demo. I decided against it because I think it's a bit much. And the message I want to give here is not that necessarily that you should all go use Tamarin right now, because I think the learning curve is unfortunately still a bit steep. But I'm more interested in showing you how to think maybe precisely about the protocols, the guarantees you want to give, and so on. And yeah, sure, if you want to check out Tamarin, it would be great. But So I want to talk a bit more about DID Exchange. So when I worked on this was for rebooting the web of Trust 9. So it's been a while, and it's possible that some of this stuff changed. So I've looked. I think it's still pretty much relevant, but also I'm going to talk about peer DID, and I think that specification changed quite a bit since that. So just as a disclaimer. So first, let's talk about the security goal of DID Exchange. It's clearly somehow agreement. Somehow we want to know who's on the other side, have like setting up a secure channel of some sort, and for that we need some agreement of, okay, who am I talking to? A is talking to B and B is talking to A, and informally we don't want that it can be man in the middle. Formally that means we need some sort of agreement, like non-injective or injective agreement properties that I mentioned before. And I also mentioned that we have to make sure to understand who are the endpoints that agree that they're talking to each other. And what I will show you on the following slides is that when the endpoints are just the DITs, or like I maybe say the controllers of the DITs, we can obtain guarantees. We can know, like, if we do things properly, I'll give one small caveat there, but if things are done properly, then if we do the DICT exchange afterwards, I know, okay, now I'm talking to the controller of the DIT on the other side. It's also when it's like a freshly generated peer DIT. I'm mostly talking about the peer. I will be talking about peer DIT exchange.
But, if I could, I think this is a really good slide. I think the goal is of DIT exchange is that two endpoints are talking at the end of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you don't know who the other is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there is not, there's a phrase you used in there that, you know, what precisely who is talking to each other. We actually don't know that. And I think the general agreement is with DIT exchange that we're not going to know that until we do things like verifiable credential exchange following a DIT exchange. So
yeah,
just I think we've generally reached that point.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very good point. I think that's become clear. So like when I heard the other calls where this was the topic, I think that's kind of agreed upon, and that's also not the main point I want to make in this. I will just say that briefly, this is somehow what you've somehow come to this conclusion, okay, endpoint and so on. I'm just saying we can this somehow can make this more precise. And the way I would put it is after the DICT exchange, I know that I'm talking to the controller of the DIT on the other side. That's the property we want from DIT exchange.
Yeah, I would agree with that one.
Okay, great. Then I think we're on the same page. Then I think I can go to the next slide, because the rest is that what's I think kind of established. So my next point that I would like to make is when we I will be talking now about peer DIT exchange. So both parties there's an invitation at the start with some recipient keys, but in the end we want peer DITs on both sides. If I understood it correctly, that's something a use case that we often want, that even like the inviter in the end is using a separate peer DIT just for this specific connection. And our goal is again that I know, okay, I'm talking to the controller of this DIT that I have here, of this peer DIT that we just exchanged. And no one is in the middle. So I have an end-to-end secure channel to this other, to the controller of this other DIT. And but that's not obvious. And when I did this for rebooting Web of Trust 9 and did an analysis in Tamarin, it turned out that there's at first I didn't model some extra like verification step, and it turns out this step is necessary. And it, since I've done a pull request since to make this explicit in the peer date spec. And so let me briefly say it. The inviter must verify that received DID was generated according to the name string generation method from the stored variant of the received generous DIT doc. That's a mouthful, so let me make it a bit clearer. So the inviter, responder who gets the connection request from the requester, this connection request contains a DID, a peer DID. So if everything is still works that way, and a DIT doc. And this DID must have been, so this DID, if an honest party sends that, what this honest party did is it generated this DID from the DIT doc, like the stored variant, so the doc that doesn't contain the DIT itself, and generated some like numerical basis from this, and then generates the DIT this way. So we have this somehow guarantees a binding between this DIT and this initial DIT doc with this initial public key material. And this is something that an attacker, for example, could send some DIT and some other DIT doc, some things that don't match. And so this is actually something that the inviter must check. And I will show you, I will go into a bit more detail in the time I have left, where I show that if the inviter does not perform this check, then an attacker controlling the network, so I assume that the DICT exchange is done, that everything is done over insecure channel. Also, the invite is sent over an insecure channel, because as if I understood it correctly, you are aiming here for some transport agnostic things, that everything can somehow happen over an insecure channel, and then we security researchers somehow assume the worst and assume that, okay, that means everything will go over an insecure channel. And so please interrupt me if I'm saying something that's just completely wrong, because that would not be good. But so on the next slide, A and B are honest parties, and I is the attacker intruder, because A is already used. And so this is a lot of details. So let me spend some time on this slide, because now I want to show you what could go wrong if this check that I mentioned is not performed. So it starts that the intruder sends an invitation to B, or some like party controlled by the intruder. Now, this is not something like, this is not an obvious attacker that where you could immediately spot that, oh, this is an invitation from a bad guy or something. So this is maybe just some web server with bad intentions, but that people are still willing to communicate with. And so, B now, okay, responds as B is honest. So the request looks correct. It has a DIT doc that contains PKB, so public key of B, and a DIT B that was generated but with properly from this DIT doc the way it's supposed to be in peer DIT, and sends this to the attacker. So now the attacker knows DIT B. Then at some later point, A is honest and sends an invitation to B. But this invitation is intercepted by the attacker, because the attacker controls the network. So this invitation, in fact, never reaches B. But what A doesn't know that. So what I now does, here in this space, I is somehow trying to impersonate B to A. So what I does is, I knows DIT B from before here. What I does, it is requests, it sends a request as if it was B who received the invitation to A, and sends a DIT doc with some PKI1. So this is some public key where the intruder, the attacker, controls their corresponding secret key, and DIT B that it learned here. So what we notice is that this doesn't match, right? This is not, the DIT doc contains PKI1, but this DIT B was generated from the DIT doc with PKB. So something's off here, but let's say A doesn't perform this check that we mentioned before, doesn't check whether this corresponds to this. Then, okay, A believes this request comes from B, because that's where A sent the invitation, responds to B, apparently to B, with an honestly generated new DIT doc with PKA, DIT A, generated from DIT doc, and encrypts this with, so it seems it, this is arrow to B is a bit not quite right, because A thinks it's talking to B, but encrypts this according to the protocol with the public key that we have here in this initial DIT doc, if I have this correct. And so actually this is sent to the attacker, and now the attacker can responds again with a new DIT doc what the attacker now does is, remember that up here B had sent a request, let me briefly see if I've got the details right. So this should go to B, right? So we're still here. So the attacker now sends this response to B. And what we have now is, so in the end, I'm not sure I got all the details right here actually, but my main point is, okay, now A has a connection with B, where A says, okay, my own DIT is DIT A, my partner's DIT is DIT B. B has a connection with A, with its own DIT being DIT B. partners did being did A, but I controls the keys in these did docs, and thus is now in full control of the connection. So if A sends a sends something to apparently end to end to B, then I can decrypt it and change it, and so can somehow man in the middle this entire connection between A and B. And especially even if, let's say, the people do perform an offline verification, like the people controlling these agents check, okay, show me what DIDs does your device display, then they see they see that everything is all right, because like the DIDs match only if you go on the lower level of public keys. Only then would you see that there's actually a mismatch, and that like A's public key is a different one from so what A believes to be B's public key is actually different from B's actual public key. So only then would you notice a problem. And so this means that really this can be a problem if this did doc to did binding is not done correctly. The questions about this slide right here.
That's a good example. It's a fairly subtle bug, but once you lay it out, it's completely obvious, but you wouldn't notice if you didn't have something pointed out to you.
Yes. And not even if didn't a tool didn't put it out, I would say it's hard to find manually. So now I would briefly just as an intro, I think my main goal is to show you, okay, in general this formal verification stuff is useful, but also I know that the peer did exchange now says to do this check, but I just wanted to, because I'm not very familiar with your implementations, I was wanted to briefly check if they perform this check.
That's a very good question.
I was just typing a message to my... Oh, sorry, Stephen, go ahead.
I'm thinking the same thing you are, Richard.
Just typing a message to my team. Are you vulnerable to this?
The other complicated factor is that what we have now is not actually what's written in the peer-did spec. It's a precursor to that, and we've never really updated it because the peer-did spec has not stopped moving. So it's a little bit messy because we don't yet have a fixed target to go after to get to this level of formal verification.
I see.
Yeah, in the I hope in the future the answer is yes, right? Mm-hmm. Or adjustments are made such that the this sort of a check is required for operation, meaning it doesn't work without it. But for now, I don't know about all implementations. But it's also, we can't just go compare it against the spec, because the spec isn't actually what we're doing now either.
I see. Yeah, that's tricky. And I think another thing that's tricky is that you're implementing like did exchange with different methods and so on. And I mean, there's lots of protocols, but it's not even one. Did exchange is not even one protocol. I would argue that peer did exchange is different from did exchange when one of them is a public did and so on. And so that's just there, but just something to maybe for you to keep in mind, that this is when you use peer dids, this is really this binding is something that's important between the originally generated did and the did doc. I think we already kind of discussed this. This is an example that this tool support really can help find subtle attacks. And yes, attempting formal verification and failing can and will discover attacks. It can also find a flaw in your modeling, but often it will actually find attacks. And so it's useful even if you do not fully trust the proof in the symbolic model. I want to make this point that this is when you get a proof, you don't have 100% security guarantee because there could be attacks outside of the model. That attacks on the cryptography, some side channels that you haven't modeled, and so on. But you rule out certain kinds of attacks on the protocol logic. So it's really not just about getting this green check mark. I think somehow that the first two parts of be precise about the properties that we want, and then B, maybe find the text. I think this is almost more useful, if you will, than actually having the okay, it's proven in the end, because this okay, it's proven has lots of yes in this model, assuming this and assuming that. The attack, it's often just an attack. So a possible attack. So that's just if there's skeptics that think, okay, proofs are proven, things have been attacked afterwards and so on, I kind of agree. And I think it can also, these tools can also be used more of as a kind of attack finding tool. I think this we can skip because we already kind of discussed that. That's just the point that, yeah, to then really know who's on the other side, you need some extra stuff like exchanging verifiable credentials. And again, that becomes very clear when you are precise about the desired security guarantees. Yeah, I think we have 1 minute. Questions.
I think we interacted a lot as the presentation went on. That was a great presentation. Thank you, Sven. Thank you.
That was awesome. Really good way of, really good presentation. I listened to a podcast recently that covered, sort of went over this type of thing as well. That would be really good. But you did a terrific job on presenting it in our context. It's excellent.
Thank you very much. I hope that I will be able to contribute to the community in some form or another in the future. But I mean, my time on not working concretely on publishable things is a bit limited. But I also think that I hope that the research community will catch on to SSI and that it's a topic worth publishing about.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. And look, I'll get the recording posted in a little bit, and so Steve and I can share it with our teams, get them to watch it, and look forward to talking to everybody in the afternoon call or next week.
Yes, that would be great if you can share it, and because I think there's also people maybe in the DITCOM call that they might be interested.
Excellent.
Okay, thank you all.
Excellent, thank you.
Thank you, bye.